Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
And one of the things that really pushed me to write the new book is that I had changed my style of DMing and prepping from the ways that I had written about in The Lazy Dungeon Master myself. And
yeah.
I felt like this is kind of hypocritical that I've got this new these new things I've discovered that have dramatically improved my game. And yet I'm still selling this book that does it differently. I really ought to do a new book that talks about this new way.
Mike Shea gives incredible insight into what it takes to make content that people will enjoy. We discuss where the concept of the Lazy Dungeon Master came from and how it's expanded. Stick around until the end when we discuss what he thinks about the future of the role-playing hobby. Interviews like this are possible because of the support of floorheads like you on Patreon. I welcome some of our newest patrons: John A. Snowberger, Mad Quacker, Zagrave, Nick Louie, Sledgend, Keller O'Leary, Robert Antony, and Peter Shepard. Okay, sit back, relax, and enjoy my discussion with Mike.
Do you love to unplug and play games around the table? Greetings, friends and floorheads, to Tabletop Talk from Third Floor Wars. If you love tabletop gaming, you are in the right place. Listen as Craig delivers in-depth discussions and interviews with game designers, creators, insiders, and experts. Learn from the people making and playing the role-playing, miniature, and board games you love.
Howdy, friends. Craig here. Today, we're talking to author and creator of Sly Flourish, Mike Shea. Mike is known for writing The Lazy Dungeon Master, Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, and one of my favorites, The Fantastic Adventures, just to name a few. Now, his website and Twitter feed are full of actionable advice that you can leverage to make your RPG games better. So, Mike, welcome to the third floor.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, there was a day when you didn't know you could have a sheet of paper and a pair of dice and pretend to be other people. And then there was the day where you found it. So I'd like to hear your gaming origin story. When did you first get exposed to the hobby?
I actually got exposed through computer games first. I played the Pool of Radiance game on my on my Laser 128, which was a Apple IIc clone.
Yeah.
Right? An illegal, the whole machine I'm pretty sure was illegal. and yeah, so I played Pool of Radiance on it, and I was like, what do all these numbers mean? Like, there's a lot of interesting numbers in here. I love this game, and I love that there's numbers, and I want to see where what they mean. Like, why is my armor class going down when I put armor on? And so I went out and bought the second edition Player's Handbook.
Nice.
And read it, and I'm like, that's why the numbers are going down when I put on armor. And then it took a couple years after that where I was in high school and I'd known about D&D. I had my oldest friend. I've known them more almost, 45 years. And he was into D&D when he was younger. He was like 13 and he was into it. And I remember he had his dad's suitcase that he would take around to people's houses that had all the OD&D box sets in them. And he actually got out of it. But I didn't get into it till about 4 or 5 years later when second edition was a thing. And so I managed to get some of my high school friends together and we played and it was like the total Monty Hall campaign. And like I had the DNPC, I had two different DNPCs that I was more than happy to give all the loot to and level them up. And one was a wizard who cast polymorph to the fighter who would turn him into a hydra so that he could do like, and then cast haste on him so you could do like 36 attacks so all my friends could watch me roll dice for half an hour because that was awesome.
That sounds fun.
And yeah, that sounds like fun. But the story was great because they were fighting Lord Manshoon, Lord of the Zinterim, back when the Zinterim were cool. like they were actual bad guys. And they went to like Darkhold and they fought him on the Zental Keep in a big tower. And I look, even back then, I'm like, that story was fun. And I actually learned a really valuable lesson when I started giving story elements to my DMPCs. So like they started to actually become part of the story that was driving the other characters. And now I'm like, that's actually the good way to have a DMPC. Is like, it's not a DMPC, it's an NPC, right?
Exactly.
And now it's projecting. So yeah, so I stopped playing near the end of high school, started again in college for a couple of years. Met another.
What brought you back?
I think I wanted to. One of these like weird serendipitous situations where I was hanging outside the lunchroom at my dorm, waiting for them to open, reading Sword of Shannara.
Nice.
And a guy came up to me and said, "Hey, you know, Sword of Shannara, that's a good book. Did you ever play D&D?" And I'm like, "Yes, I did." And he's like, "Do you want to play?" I'm like, "Yes, I do." And he's like, "Great, you're the DM." And I'm like, "Okay." So that guy turned out to be a disaster.
That's funny.
One of the other guys at that table ended up being a lifelong friend of mine. He was the best man at my wedding. So he and I played D&D. Then we started playing Magic the Gathering and stopped playing D&D.
Yeah.
And then I got a job. I moved out to Washington D.C. I played EverQuest like the devil for 5 years, and met my wife through EverQuest. And she had friends who played D&D, and I became their DM. And so that was probably 2004 or so. And from that point onward, we've been playing 3.5, 4, 5, Pathfinder, and everything else. And it's been pretty much a nonstop. I still play with, So obviously my wife and I, have played together ever since. And two of our friends that we played in that original group, we now play with in a different game. But we moved and people moved. And now I've basically, since we moved here, so about 15 years, we've had a regular group. But people come in and out, right? So there's like been a core group of about three of us who have always, or four of us that have been there. And then we've had other people come in and out throughout the game.
So did you guys ever get non-D&D curious? Have you guys explored outside of D&D?
More than curious. Oh, yeah. So we played, I don't know if Pathfinder counts, but we played Pathfinder for a little while. But we played a lot of Fate. We played a lot of 13th Age. We played Numenera. We played Shadow of the Demon Lord. What else? I'm sure there's some other games.
But D&D has been your primary.
Yeah, but I've just always loved D&D, right? And I love it even more now. Like I think if I didn't have 5th edition, I'd probably be playing something like 13th Age, which
That's
is still kind of D&D, right? But it's like a refined 4E style that I really think is great. But I love 5th, and like I'm amazed at my own attitude towards it, because like I was ready to leave 3.5 when 4E came out. Like I was ready to jump ship, and I did. And I played 4E, and by the end of that, I was ready to leave 4E and go to something new. And then 5 came out, and I played 5th, and now I'm totally happy with 5th. And I don't have any real like I played my last campaign with a bunch of house rules only because I never had really house ruled it. And now I've thrown them all away. I'm like, I'm pretty good with vanilla 5E. Like I don't really feel like I need a lot of house rules.
That's a big deal.
I feel like it's a sign that it's a really strong system. I think there's a lot of evidence that it's a really strong system.
Yeah,
but also it's a system that supports me really well. And
how so?
It's got the right amount of juicy mechanics to keep players interested, and to like even these guys that I'm friends of mine that I've been playing with for years and years now, we're still trying new things and trying new builds and all of that, and they still like watching their characters do cool stuff. But it still has everything I need to like really be a story focused, story focused DM. It's got a good amount of flexibility. In some areas you're like, I wish it was a little more in some directions than others, but it's got enough flexibility that like people can play it real heavily tactically with a grid, while other people like me can play Theater of the Mind and very dramatic with a lot of dramatic fare, and the game still works.
That's
so
cool.
I think it fit that right balance. It feels kind of old schooly, right? But it also has enough of the new tech, as they like to say. It's got enough of the new tech to make it work, right?
They had a very interesting, it was smart on their part, a very interesting group of people involved, so you had like Schwalb in there, making sure you had some of that old school feel in it.
Monty
but
Cook
you had
was
some
there
people
for a time.
That that looked at it differently, and didn't quite make, and you know, came back from four strong is probably the best way to do it.
Yeah, and obviously.
I appreciate the recent maybe four wasn't that bad kind of thing going on. And the reason I appreciate it is because, I mean, we can shit on four all day long, right? For a lot of very legitimate reasons, but it brought a ton of people into the game. Now, not like fifth, but there was a lot of people that went from video games. They weren't like you. They didn't go from video games to two, right? People were playing video games then and then saw the pen and paper and were like, what the hell? But I've talked to a lot of people that, you know, were playing, you know, video games on their Xbox and their PlayStations and were able to slide, or more importantly, playing MMOs and were able to slide into four. Am I saying that four is better, but.
Yeah, like Mike Krahulik from Penny Arcade said that, right? Like he wasn't, you know, Jerry was a D&D guy from way back in the day, and Mike was not. But he's like, hey, it's got cards, and I understand cards, right? Power cards and stuff like that. And then he got into it in a huge way, having not been into it before. And it was 4E that kind of that brought him in. It's funny because, like, I guess I've definitely hit a grognardy sort of level where when I see all the love for 4E, I'm like, where were all you people when I was back there doing this stuff?
Right? I could not agree more.
I feel like it's the other part
kind of craft beerish.
Yeah, a little bit, right? Like, come on, I was in the trenches, right? I was there at the Pathfinder 4E battle at Gen Con in 2014. Where were you? Right? And so some of that is coming from there. And then there's other things where, like, the things that people liked about it, I'm like, no, like, you don't know what you're talking about, right? Like, I was there, I wrote this stuff, you know, I published this stuff, and I could tell you it didn't work like you think it worked, you know? And the one is, like, skill challenges. Like, people love the idea of skill challenges. And all I can think about is how they worked in 4E, and they didn't, right? They were not a good, it wasn't a good design, and there's a reason why they're not in fifth, and it's because they lock you into a single path, and they take away a lot of the creativity of the characters. And then what people come back with is, well, that's not the kind of skill challenge I'm talking about. And I'm like, okay, well then you're not talking about skill challenges.
Exactly. Right? Don't tell me it was the 4E skill challenge. Right.
And new things I'm good with. Like, a lot of people, no, I meant like the progression clocks and Blades in the Dark. And I'm like, that's a different thing. And that is really cool. And that can work. You know, but as written, like, go read the first Dungeon Master's Guide for 4E and read the kind of skill challenges they had in there. And they're a mess.
Well, so, and when you talk to people with different, when the addition discussions happen, which are typically a waste of time, but when they do happen, you do have to do exactly what you're talking about, which is you can't assume that they were playing it the same way you were, right?
Right.
And you have to have that conversation, which is a tribute to the game. The other thing that I don't think is talked about enough, and I give 5E credit for, is the ability for, I don't think they lost anybody from four. So you had people that did play four.
Yeah.
They liked four. And the fact that they were able to slide into five is a compliment, I think, to five. Because it was different enough.
Yeah, there are some, like you said, who went into fifth and then felt like they threw the baby out with the bathwater with four. And you know, people that I you know, friends of mine who are were part of both versions of D&D, you know, say that like they, there's some stuff they took out that really they could have kept in, and that would have been better. And they're not wrong. You know, they're not wrong with that. But even them, I think they still, I think you're right. I think. And I think 5E is like, it's got to be like five times bigger than 4E was.
At least.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's been doubling and doubling and doubling. And now they said during COVID, when it feels like half the companies in America went out of business, they had 30% growth.
You know, if you had told me, Mike, and you and I are similar age, if you had told me 10 years ago, let alone, you know, 20 years ago, that Hasbro would be restructuring the company around Dungeons and Dragons, like, I would have laughed at you.
Right.
And then you would have told me they made a Doctor Strange movie, and I would have laughed at you again.
Yeah. Well, like, and I love it because every so often I talk to people and they're like, D&D needs to do X, right? Like, D&D needs to add this thing in there. And you're like, I don't think so. Like, I'm pretty sure they don't need
to do anything.
Okay. Right. Yeah. They're doing fine. Well, yeah. And, you know, and part of it is like, you know, again, like, you weren't there back in the Gen Con Wars of 2013, but, like, you know, back in the Gen Con Wars of 2013, everyone was talking about how D&D was going to die with Gen Xers, right? That it was the end. Like, this was the death throw. And I kind of wonder if WotC thought that when they were making fifth and said, this is our homage to the old ways of D&D.
Interesting.
It's like it's our last, like, you know, hey, we just want to have we know it's not going to sell. It's not going to be a big deal. We're only going to have like five people work on it. but we're going to put it out there, and it'll be like, you know, it'll be sort of the evergreen D&D that's kind of like the old game. It has some new stuff in it. And if you read the Dungeon Master's Guide, that's kind of how the DMG reads, is like, it doesn't tell you how to play D&D, right? It's just like, here's a bunch of things that make D&D D&D. You know, and I wonder if they felt, if at some level when they were writing that and they were working on it, if they thought like, this is kind of the end of the brand, you know, and then it turned out like, no, it's the most popular version of D&D ever. I'm pretty sure nobody would have predicted that.
No, I mean, right up until, you know, the first year that fifth edition was out, every conversation at every about role-playing games is, why is our hobby dying? Why is the hobby? Why is it getting smaller?
How are we going to do anything about this?
Right? How are we going to revitalize it? Four didn't work.
No one's saying that anymore. Yeah.
Nope.
That conversation's gone. And it's kind of gone with a whimper, right? You kind of want like all those people to come back and be like, this is so awesome. Like our hobby's not dead. And instead they just change their argument to something else. Right. Now it's like, well, you know, I don't like that it doesn't have this thing. And like, oh,
yeah. Yeah. Whatever. And not to get into it, because honestly, I don't want to, but then you get the people bitching about it because it's gotten big. Right. And,
yeah.
You know, complaining because
there's the 4E stuff is a little of that. Like there's part of me that's like, is this a little, it's a little hipstery, right? A little like that, you know, 5E's not cool anymore, but loving 4E's cool. And again, I'm like, you know, where were you? Right. Like I was writing stuff. Nobody cared. Right.
That's really funny, Mike. That's funny. So guys, the Insider Insight series is my opportunity to sit down with designers, developers, artists, writers, and creators and learn about how they approach their work. I try to understand their process, inspiration, and methods for crafting their creations. And that's what we're going to do with Mike today. So we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from this break, we're going to talk about starting the Sly Flourish brand. We'll be right back. This is the part of many podcasts where someone comes on, interrupts the show, and explains that you should consider paying for the content that you're listening to right now for free. That pitch man explains by giving a dollar or more a month, you not only support the show, but you allow the show to grow and improve. Here on the third floor, we refuse to interrupt your episode of Tabletop Talk with such time-wasting pleas. We pledge never to run a spot asking you to go to patreon.com and give a dollar or more a month, because supporting content creators keeps the content coming, even if there is a link in the show's description. And there is. We don't ask you to click it and become a patron. We don't waste time rambling about the benefits like early access to episodes, getting episodes without ad breaks like this, or even getting a chance to play in one of Craig's RPG sessions. Anyway, enjoy this episode, knowing Tabletop Talk, despite being supported by its patrons, won't engage in such blatant appeals for support. So, Mike, you're a GM, right? You're a DM, right? So am I, right? And I was when I was younger, and I am as an adult now. And a lot of people listening have run games, but not everybody has made another step, which is to actually create content. And for whatever reason you have, right? You have decided that I'm going to do more than just play, do more than just create at the table. I'm going to create in a bigger sense. So I'm going to the Sly Flourish Museum. Right. And I go and there's a whole list of exhibits there. And I'm going to go to the first exhibit that shows me where it started. So when did the first idea come about that I wanted to not just create at the table? I wanted to do a little bit more. When did that happen?
So it probably happened at the D&D Experience in Washington, D.C., which was I guess it was Winter Fantasy. Winter Fantasy and the D&D Experience kind of merged. So it was Winter Fantasy when they first announced 4th edition, and they had the demo of 4th edition. And I went to it here. I live in the DC area, and my wife and I went to it, and we played, and I pulled out my iPhone 1 that I waited in line for, and I took pictures of the character sheets and stuff, because nobody said I couldn't, and I hadn't signed any NDA or anything like that. And I posted it to a Tumblr account, and said, hey, check this out. Like, you know, do we have enough material here to actually play fourth edition at home? Was there enough, like, between the character sheets and, like, you know, basically, and then what little we understood of monsters, do we have enough to play 4E at home? And I don't think Wizards of the Coast was particularly happy with that, but nobody said anything. And they ended up letting me freelance later, so they can't have been that pissed off.
Sure.
And, you know, so I started with that, and it got a lot of attention. It got, like, RPG Net and N World and other people linked to it. And like, hey, this is like a, you know, person that was there that saw this who bothered me. And blogging wasn't a thing really. And, you know, I mean, I guess blogging was blogging was kind of a thing, but like mobile blog, Twitter wasn't even around. And so there wasn't this sort of, you know, nowadays you go anywhere, there's a million pictures of everything, but back then there really wasn't. So I saw, like, oh wow, people really like this. They're interested in the 4E stuff. What if I did a 4E blog? What if I wrote a blog about fourth edition? And then I was like, what if, but I like the DMing side, so let other people talk about the player bits and I'll just talk about DMing. And then, so what if I did a blog that's just about how to get better at running fourth edition D&D?
Nice.
Like, what would that be like? And so I started that blog a little bit after, like, fourth edition had already been out at that point. They put out the three core books. They had Keep of the Shadowfell, which is like their version of the starter adventure for fourth. And I started writing a blog about it. And I'd already done a lot of blogging in the past. I was a big home theater nerd, so I did I had a big home theater blog for about 10 years. I had a personal blog that was all over the place with whatever I wanted to write there, but eventually turned into a fountain pen review website because I like fountain pens. And that's where I learned about affiliate money. And I was like, hey, wow, I'm making $12 every time I sell a fountain pen. So writing, I had written regularly, like on the 500 word a day style of writing, like for a decade before I started the D&D book. Oh, I wrote a huge EverQuest. I had a bunch of EverQuest stuff too. So I wrote a blog about EverQuest, and I also wrote a bunch of fan fiction for EverQuest. So I got like all my bad words out. Yeah.
Before we go beyond that though, like what's driving that for you? So let's not even talking about Sly first. Like, you have a desire to publish, you have a desire to share. Do you have a sense of where that comes from?
Probably my dad. So my dad was a freelance. He was an independent author. He wrote a novel called Illuminatus, science fiction cult novel back in the 70s, and then wrote a bunch of historical fiction. So he was a writer. So I was kind of around that. I don't know if I go so far to say like it's actually in the blood, but it was around me as a profession my whole life.
You knew that people did that.
I knew that people did that. And I remember I was like fourth or fifth grade when I realized that like I would get like a 10-page fiction assignment and I'd come in with 20. Nice. And I realized like, wow, I can write. You know, like I write and I enjoy it. Like writing for pleasure was a thing even, you know, when I was a kid. I wrote a journal for a long time that was mostly filled with angst. And, you know, but it got me doing words regularly, right? It got me into that habit of doing
words
regularly.
The only way to be a writer is you got to write.
you got to write. And so, like, I did it back in college. I had a blog about Doom, the original Doom and Quake.
Nice.
And so I wrote a blog about that. So, yeah, writing has always been pretty easy for me. And I like it. Right.
Nice.
And I think I got a lot of bad words out early, which helped so that, you know, my words later were not so bad. And
so it sounds like you were primed then kind of here. You'd already had the experience. You were familiar with the medium and, you know, building an audience and stuff like that. And then so you say, OK, I'm going to create something that focuses on 4E and being a DM in 4E. Did you have a sense of your voice right out of the gate, or is that something that took a little bit of time to find?
I've never even thought about my voice.
Okay.
But like one thing is like I'm a shrunken white, you know, acolyte, right? So I kind of early on, I sort of latched onto that book as the idea that that's good writing. And I know there's lots of arguments about whether it is or isn't, but it stuck with me. And that idea of like omit needless words and, you know, speak plain, right? And so that was the style that I took. And I wrote a lot of fiction, so it wasn't like a, you know, flowery narrative was out of my world. But I would say if I have a voice, it's that. And I've had other people comment and say, and my friend Teos Abadia, the Alpha Stream, has said that like one of the things about that, that he has respected me, that he's respected with me, is that I can take a complex thing and do it in a few words. Right.
You're easy to read, Mike, and that's a compliment.
Yeah. But it's
an easy read.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I think if I have a voice, that's it. Brevity, brevity above all, and trying to get that. But I've never said, it's never, and I don't know what it's like for other writers either, but I don't know how much I don't give any attention to, whether this sounds like me. Right.
Sure.
I'm always about what am I trying to say? A lot of times when I'm writing an article, at the top, I'm just like, what am I really trying to say? And I try to have that one sentence focal point that says what I'm really trying to. And if I can't come up with that, that means I need to rethink this whole thing. Right. Maybe even throw it away and start over. But if I can come up with that one nugget, and sometimes I keep it in there, and that's the first sentence in the article. I'm like, you don't have to read anything else if you don't want, right? That one sentence will tell you what I'm trying to say. And then the rest is sort of backing up the thought or going into some more depth. But that's always kind of been how I approach it. And
so let's talk about growth, Mike. The way I am finding when I talk to a lot of creators that the growth works is, you have the steady growth, right? The word of mouth and, hey, if you check this guy out and so on, but then you have spikes and plateaus. And I'd be curious to know what some of the early spikes were. So where were times where you just saw the audience jump and why did it happen?
Yeah. Luck. No one wants to hear that luck is the right. No one wants to hear it. But the truth is, it's the right place at the right, be the right place at the right time. So for me, my first spike was when I was starting to do my daily D&D tweets, and Mike Krahulik retweeted something I had done. I think he retweeted an article, or I think he didn't even just retweet it. He posted a tweet saying, if you want to read good 4E stuff, check out this guy's blog.
Nice.
Right. And that was a big spike. Right. That was immediately double the audience that I was getting. And it's one of those butterfly effects. You're like, I don't know what effect that has had down to this day or not.
Yeah.
Right. But at the time it was a big one. And having Mike Krahulik say something like that, I was like, oh, thanks, Mike. Yeah, that's good. I was very appreciative. And of course I wanted to I double down and all, and it's no, that was it. So that was one spike. I would say another spike was publishing The Lazy Dungeon Master. I had put out two other sort of D&D self-help books before that, the Lazy DM or Dungeon Master Tips and Running Epic Tier Games. Dungeon Master Tips sold well and continues to sell now, even though it was written during the fourth edition day. And, I think you could probably get a lot of it. I think I even need giving it away at this point. I'm not sure. I think you can get the text online. What doing The Lazy Dungeon Master, which didn't feel to me any different than any of the other books I wrote, that resonated with people. The ideas that were in that book stuck with people, and that it was a real problem that people had of I don't have enough time. There's few ideas. Run, I don't have enough time. How can I still run a game when I don't really have time to prepare it? Right, was one. But then the other one is, how can my game be better by the fact that I didn't prepare? Right. Or that I prepared less, or how do I prepare so that the game is the most fun, was, a new concept for me when I wrote it. Right.
Yeah.
Something I'd heard from DMs. It was right at that transition between fourth and fifth edition. It was during the D&D Next Days when that book came out. But that was another spike. Right. That one, I can look at my, if I look just at revenue, I have this every month I do all my bookkeeping, and I have a chart that's from the beginning of when I took a dollar to now, and you can see these occasional spikes, and that was that was the first big revenue spike, first popularity spike is probably the Mike Krahulik thing. The next clearest one that had another big sort of powers of 10 increase was Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, which was that wasn't luck, but it was certainly unpredicted. I was afraid I was going to wreck the idea with a new book. I was worried that I was going to put another book out and everybody's going to be like, wait, I already have the other one. Which one should I get? Or why are there two? Never mind. I'll get neither. Right. And I worried about that. And the very first review on Amazon was, I like the other book better. And I was like, well, that sucks. Right. But I did a Kickstarter. So I'm like, well, at least the book's paid. right? Like, I'm not gonna lose money. And the Kickstarter did very well, so I was pretty happy overall, because I mean the Kickstarter alone had sold more than all of the original Lazy Dungeon Master did, so that worked out really well. People were definitely interested in that. It's still my most popular, most successful Kickstarter, and it was done a long time ago. So that was definitely another big spike when that came out. And I would say the next biggest one has happened pretty recently, probably within the last couple of months.
Wow.
Yeah. And I can attribute it to essentially two things: newsletters, having a newsletter that I start to care for, and doing a lot more with YouTube and being more conscious of what I'm putting up on YouTube. And both of those have resulted in a large sort of, you know, new set of attention. And I think I, you know, kind of studying that, the lesson I would take from it is to always, you know, I'm saying this to myself, I'm not offering advice, because advice is generally BS, you know, but if I was to take a lesson from it myself and ponder it, the lesson would be always be evolving to fit the new mediums, more so than like which one of your social networks, because like Twitter was a big deal and isn't now. Right. Like, influence on Twitter is not nearly as big as people think it is. And in fact, I think it's dangerous, because people think you have more influence than you do. And then you say something dumb and everyone's like, you're hurting the whole world. I'm going to come to your house. Right. And you're like, no one's listening, man. You were the only one. Right. The algorithms don't care. So and that was one where, like, you know, YouTube turned out to be a much more useful social media network for promoting stuff than Twitter has been in the last year or so.
Yeah. And to your point, Mike, you've got to meet your audience where they are. Right. You know, we're not, you like to think that if I'm just going to put out good content, people will find me. That's not how it works. Right. That's not how it works, you know? And I've had people say to me, you know, why are you on Twitch and YouTube? And I said, because there's people that are on Twitch and there's people that are on YouTube. That's why. And you have to run out and you've got to meet them there. So guys, let's take a quick break. When we get back from this break, I want to dig in a little bit more on this Lazy Dungeon Master concept. It's how I first found Mike, and I want to find out where the hell it came from. We'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Are you a tabletop RPG player that is considering becoming a game master? Are you a veteran GM that is always looking for different ways to improve your games? GM Mastermind is an RPG podcast that tackles topics catering to the art of game mastering.
But Craig, there are a lot of RPG podcasts that do that.
Perhaps. But GM Mastermind has the brain trust. It's a guest panel made up of 2 to 3 game masters from different backgrounds and experiences that share their personal insights on a particular topic. This keeps the conversation fresh, diverse, and insightful from one episode to the next. So head over to gmmastermind.com or subscribe to GM Mastermind wherever you find your favorite podcasts. So I've been curious, when I was reading The Lazy Dungeon Master, which I thoroughly enjoyed, and I bought the second book, and it's good that you wrote a second book, just for those of you listening. One of the first things that popped into my mind, and I don't know, I mean, you talk about it a little bit, but I want to talk to you about it, is, had you solved the problem, then you wrote the book, or did you identify the problem
and then say, I want to write a book about it, and then figured it out. Like, where was the cart? Where was the horse? You know, was it a situation, Mike, where you were, you know, you, this is how I was running games for 5 years and I realized nobody else was. So I wrote a book about it. So can you kind of give me an idea of how that all came together, the concept? And we should probably give people a little bit of an overview, too.
Sure. Do you want me to start with the overview?
Whatever you prefer, my friend. I just throw like 10 questions at you.
Yeah, no, I'm good. Now, one thing I'll say that kind of leads back to another one is that about, you know, let's talk about me. But
that's what this podcast is about.
Yeah, yay. So my favorite podcast about me. So is about writing. Now, writing has been a way, it sounds so pretentious, but writing is a way for me to explore the world.
Sure.
Right? Writing is thinking for me. I think that's true for a lot of people, but writing
is
thinking for me.
That's why I asked the question, yeah.
Yeah. And that's, so when you, you know, it, as it relates to this and the idea, like, was I solving the problem when I wrote it? I mean, kind of a little bit of both, right? To give sort of a summary of Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, and I'll try to do this in like 30 seconds. One, you know, it's a book that kind of has three major looks. How you prepare for your game, how you run your game, and how you think about your game. And then it's broken into a bunch of chapters for each of those three main sections. And most people get the best value from the how do you prepare for your game chapter, which breaks game preparation down into 8 steps. And the eight steps are: review the characters, come up with a strong start, outline your scenes, come up with 10 secrets and clues, come up with some fantastic locations for your characters to explore, come up with some interesting NPCs, figure out what monsters make sense for the situation, and figure out what treasure you're going to reward. I know my book well enough that I could whip those out without even looking at anything. So
I'd be worried if you didn't.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes I screwed up. I'm actually quite proud of myself. So, so that I consider like the framework, right? And so that came about during writing the book, but right, major pieces of those were things that I was doing. And one of the things that really pushed me to write the new book is that I had changed my style of DMing and prepping from the ways that I had written about in The Lazy Dungeon Master myself. And yeah, I felt like this is kind of hypocritical that I've got this new, these new things I've discovered that have dramatically improved my game, and yet I'm still selling this book that does it differently. Yeah. I really ought to do a new book that talks about this new way.
So not even talking about the content wise, stylistically, what had changed between that? Like, how had you, as strictly a DM, not a producer or a writer, how were you running games differently?
So the biggest one, and you said it's more stylistically than specific, but I can't really separate the two. But like,
sure.
So the big one was secrets and clues. That, you know, step 4, I think, is secrets and clues. And I started doing that. I started using like the lazy DM style of, which also sort of has it, but it's kind of 3 steps instead of 8. And yep, the problem is you kind of need some other steps when you're doing it. You can't really just get away with 3. Sometimes you can, but sometimes you can't. And so I started doing the secrets and clues, and I picked it up from a couple of video games that I was playing. I'm big into the From Software games, the Dark Souls games. And there's one called Bloodborne. That was the first one I played. Frustrating, and you controller throwing game. But yeah, one thing that was really cool is that you had no idea what the story was, but every item you picked up had like a one line bit of lore that told you what the story was over time. And I was like, that's a really powerful idea. Can we do that in D&D? And then I was like, well, what if we didn't even time to an item? We just write them down, and then when the item shows up, we drop a secret on it, right? And I started doing that, and I'm like, wow, this is changing my game, right? This is, you know, I always thought, like, we know what the roleplay pillar is in D&D. We know what the combat pillar is, but what exactly the hell is the exploration pillar? Yeah. What does that even look like? And to me, I was like, these secrets and clues are the exploration pillar. This is the reward that characters get by exploring things. And I will throw that out there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it worked really well. And it worked well for me for years. And I was like, I gotta put this in there. So that's one that I brought into the book when I was writing it. But then there were others like outlining scenes and, you know, what treasure, you know, where I realized, like, what do you really have a game if you had nothing? And it's like, you can't not write down an outline of what scenes you're going to run. Like, everybody does that. So I was like, it's got to be in there. That was actually the last step that made it. It was 7 steps. And I'm like, that, it doesn't make sense not to have that. It's weird not to have that. So I was like, that's got to go in. There's also, you know, I'll give you a little secret here. There's kind of a ninth uh-oh step too. I know. And it's not quite like I need to write a new book worthy, but hooks. What are the hooks that draw the characters into the story? What are those hooks? And the reality is you can pack those in your start, or you can throw them in secrets, right, or you can throw them in scenes. There's lots of places to drop them in. And I don't want 9 steps because now it's getting complicated. But like, you know, 8 is more than enough. And
you're pushing
and
it.
Yeah, you're pushing it. And 9, like, you know, I wouldn't be able to rattle them off like I did before if I had 9. But the reality is that's probably one. I don't want to say it's missing, but it should have probably had more attention than it did.
Maybe a little bit more explicit, maybe.
Yeah. I guess most of the time it's like you kind of don't need hooks because you kind of already know where you're going.
Right.
But they're important enough. And it's like, that certainly is missing if you don't have it in an adventure you're writing. You know, characters need reasons to go on adventures.
Yeah. And I think one of the things I thought was very interesting, and sometimes you outline it a little bit in the books, but I think it's more hinted at, is this idea of, you know, player driven and, mm-hmm. you know, don't make those decisions. Just set the scenes and, you know, lay the table and let the players do what the players do. And what I love about, you know, don't come up with 3 secrets, come up with a nice chunky handful.
So you
have options, right? You haven't limited yourself. And I thought that was excellent. Do you find yourself when you're running games, Mike, to really let the players kind of drive the narrative? And if so, when do you get involved? So when do you come in and go, hey, you know, let's push over here with a hook, or let's move over here with a secret.
Yeah. So I call it like situation based gaming, and I'm not the only one that's written about this. Like Justin Alexander and the Alexandrian has written about it, and lots of people talk about this idea. And it doesn't always happen. Like it's not, you know, not every D&D game is like it, but when it is, it's really kind of fun. And that's that idea. Like, you know, I ran a game on Sunday. Characters are going to a Duergar outpost, right? And the situation is they have to go to the Duergar outpost. It's filled with a bunch of Duergar, and they have to find out what threat the Duergar are to 10 towns, right? To the place that they're trying to defend. So they had a goal, they had a location, they had people at the thing, and then they can take whatever approach they want. And the chapter, it's from a published adventure, but I recognize like, oh, that's a great situation. And I don't know what path they're going to take. So then it's like, well, while they're exploring it, they can see there's a front door and they could go kick in the front door. You know, they can see that there's a frozen river leading to a culvert at the base of the wall. So they know they can get in there. And there's this strange watchtower, right? So they can, you know, try to figure out what's going on with the watchtower. And I've run it for multiple groups, and they actually both ran it the same way, but there were these options and I didn't know what direction they were going to take. Right. And it was fun to kind of see how they approached it. Are they sneaky? Are they trying to pretend to be somebody they're not? Do they just get into a big fight? So I let it go. So on the order of like, well, when do you have to kind of cattle prod him a little bit, was I had one of the players who's kind of the one who's the most driven to sort of have the group go a certain way, who's like, I think we can leave now. Like, yeah, I think it's time to go. It looks real dangerous in there. Let's go. And I had to be like, do you have everything you need to answer that question? And he's like, nope, I guess we're going back in. Right. Right. And so that was one where I kind of had to like shove him a little bit, you know, because it's like, you didn't actually accomplish your goal, right? Which you do, but you're not thinking about the goal right now. So there is that, like, you have to reiterate the goal a couple of times to make sure that they know why they're there. It's very common in a situation-based scene to have the players go, why are we here again? Right. And this is that, you know, a new rule of thumb that I have, which is like the players are only getting about half of what you're talking about. Right. And so you have to say it twice or more than twice to make it clear, especially when they have these open-ended scenes, right? Like, the scene from The Final Enemy and Ghosts of Saltmarsh, where they go and they're at a Suhuigan bay. It's basically a temple that the Suhuigan took over, and it's submerged. And your reason to go there isn't wipe out the Suhuigan, because there's like 200 of them, but it's there to see, like, to do recon. Yep. So you want to give them like, here are the things that the government is, that the Council of Saltmarsh wants you to find out. And I'm going to write them down on the 3x5 card to put it in front of you so that when you're there, you know why you're there and you're ready to do it.
Yep.
But yeah, there is some talk about situation-based D&D gaming in Return, mostly in like the separation of monsters and locations and kind of recognizing that these are dynamic and fluid situations, but there isn't like a specific, you know, chapter on it. In the next book there will be.
Oh, look at you. So I'd be curious, Mike, you already kind of talked about this a little bit. You talked about the first Amazon review on return and saying, you know, I like the first book better. I'm always fascinated, you know, it's yeah. one thing to write. It's one thing to get stuff out there. It's always very interesting to hear what comes back. So I'd be curious, you know, over the years now, because, you know, the two books weren't written yesterday. Can you think of any feedback, positive or negative? I don't care, that surprised you, stuff that you didn't
that's a
anticipate.
Good question. I did. I mean, this chicken shit answer, but like, am I allowed to swear? I'm sorry. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear. So like, it surprised me how popular it was. Right. And I'll tell you,
it's legit.
I know, but it sounds so bad. It surprises me every time. I remember I listened to an interview with the guy who talked about, I think it was Wickonomics, and he talked about the idea of like the wisdom of the crowds when it came to prediction, right? And that he had done a bunch of studies and research that showed that, you know, when you have 1,000 people guessing something, it's usually better than if you have a couple of experts guessing.
Sure.
And so the interview that I was listening to, they said like, hey, we actually ran the experiment. And he's like, uh-oh. And it turned out to be right. And he's like, whoo. Right. And he's like, I'm always waiting for somebody to tell me I'm wrong. And that's kind of what I'm waiting for. Right. Like I always kind of like, you know, always like antsy when I see an email or something. And I'm like, this is going to be a person like, hey, I switched to your style. My group left. Right. Like, turns out this is terrible.
And I'm on Twitter. I'm coming to your house.
Yeah, and I read about Twitter and I think you're hurting D&D and I'm coming to your house. So like, I, you know, I'm always surprised by how many people just it resonated and it worked. It worked for them. And I'm really glad. But, you know, there's kind of science in that book, but not really. So, you know, it's not like I ran 10, you know, 1,000 groups with this style and another 1,000, a different style, and did a big study and found out it absolutely is the right idea. Yeah. It was like, no, this is working for me. And I've talked to a lot of DMs and I've, you know, I've kept my eyes open at how this works. And I think that this works. And I'm really glad it does.
That's cool.
So yeah, I'm happy and I'm a surprise because I haven't seen a lot of people who have. There have been a few who are like, this is bad. And there is at least one that I know of who is like, you're ruining D&D. I think there's at least two that I know of. They said I'm ruining D&D.
You're not a content creator if you're not ruining the game you're writing
right.
about.
Right, and I'm also
that's
like,
a,
you know,
a rite of passage.
Well, yeah, lucky me having all that impact, right?
You know? Yeah.
So
wait till Watsy finds you.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So they'll come to my house.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So, yeah. I'm trying
what
to think
was,
of
what was their contention out of curiosity, Mike? So the person that said you were ruining D&D, do you remember what
yes.
their beef was?
So in one case it was, well, so there's actually a couple of arguments and I think this has come up from a few people. Some people really hate the idea of being referred to as lazy. Right, they're like, I'm working my ass off to make
it's
this game
great
running.
Fucking title, dude.
I know. And then like, yeah, you don't know how sticky that title is, right? I have another guy who's a big like, he's a marketing guy and he knows it. He's like, man, you did well with that title. I'm like, I know, it's luck. It's like, oh, I'm so jealous.
Yeah.
So you know, right? And I get it. Like, of course, it's not lazy, but efficient. You know, the efficient dungeon master isn't as sticky. So. But they don't like they really hang on tight to the banner of DM and they don't like the idea of being considered lazy and that's fine. Like, then don't be lazy, work your ass off on stuff no one cares about, you know, you won't be the only one. And so one argument was that one argument is that sort of the loosey-goosey nature, particularly the willingness to change things behind the scenes, is an antithesis of D&D. That's not how you're supposed to be. The game is set a certain way.
Right.
When those goblins are on the table, there are that many. They won't change. They don't do stupid things. They have as many hit points as the book says they have. You know, and the idea of like you're cranking the dials in the background. You know, they don't like that idea of the man behind the curtain, right? They feel like they are truly objective and it's supposed to happen a certain way. And if it sucks and everyone hates it, that's the will of the gods.
Yeah, right? I didn't play the adventure because you made some changes. So I, you know, this wasn't actually the adventure.
Right. One of the things that got me to not run organized play adventures was I ran an organized play adventure and I changed the spell listings for one of the NPCs. And one of the players knew I had. And I'm like, well, first of all, shame on you for knowing this adventure so well that you know what spells the bad guy has prepared. But second, I'm not a spreadsheet, right? Like,
exactly.
You could go home and play and not have anybody change anything. But it was enough that I was like, you know what? That's what people are, and this isn't always true. And I'm it's years later, but like, I was like, well, if this is what organized play people want, I'm not the best DM because I changed things all the time.
Yeah, I've had players, you know, they're saying, you know, I'm really anxious to read this adventure, because most of the stuff I do is at least starts with something that's been published, right? Most of the games I run start with something published, and then I just kind of see where it goes from there. And I tell them, I'm like, you're going to be disappointed. Because, you know, I go off the rails real fast,
right?
Because I follow you. And, you know, you're not going to you'll read stuff in this adventure that was never going to be in our game.
Right.
So it's not like you didn't find it. It was never going to be there. So, yeah, I could see that. I can see where people get ticked off by that. But I don't know. I feel like I'm more in your camp, Mike, where I feel like they're missing out by not running games that way.
Sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, guys, we're going to take another break. When I get back from this break, I want to take advantage of the fact that Mike has been here the whole time playing these games. And he's kind of tuned into what's happening today. So we're going to talk about games. We're going to talk about the industry. We'll be right back.
You like science fiction, right? You love playing games, maybe even role-playing games. But what if you can't get your friends together for a game night? If you love games like Mothership or Orbital Blues, check out Dead Belt, a card-based space western solo strategy RPG about skillful and desperate scavengers picking over the remains of junked starships in hopes of a juicy payday. In it, you deal with lurking dangers, push your luck, and walk away with enough cred to keep on flying. Of course, you might get eaten by lurking aliens, or run afoul of rival scavengers, or face the murderous ghosts of long-dead spacers. No one said life in the Dead Belt was going to be easy. For more information on this and all of Sean and Abby Drake's games, swing over to acoupleofdrakes.com. The link's in the show notes.
So we really spent some time already, Mike, just talking about how much you love 5e. And in full transparency, I D&D is not my game. But I like, for me, that's not a, like an issue, right? Like, if I find somebody who loves D&D, we're playing the same stuff. We're in the same hobby. I'm a firm believer in that. It doesn't matter whether you're playing Blades in the Dark, you're playing, you know, Dungeons and Dragons. We're all, this is role playing. This is what we do. So I know how much you love it, and I completely agree with you. So it, me not playing it is not a commentary, because it's a phenomenal system and it's a great game. But I would really be interested in either things coming for D&D or that have come out recently for D&D or non-D&D. Like, what are you like really psyched about right now? Is there something that's coming that's got you excited, or something that's come out recently that has really occupied your brain space and gotten you pretty psyched up?
I have a U-Haul of Dwarven Forge coming later this year. So
nice.
That'll be fun. As a guy who plays a lot of Theater of the Mind, you always want to have lots of Dwarven Forge on hand. I mean, I'm always eager to see kind of the future progression of the stuff that Wizards of the Coast puts out. So I know they have, I think, three books coming out this year. One is an adventure, one's a another Magic the Gathering setting, and then some mysterious third book that hasn't been announced yet. And I'm eager to see what the next adventure is going to be like. I'm also a little apprehensive because I haven't been crazy about the last couple that have come out, right?
What's been your struggles with the last couple?
They're not helping me as a DM run the game. Yeah, I feel like I've had to make significant changes to get them to run the way I want them to run, and where I much prefer to have the option to make them go that way. So when I ran Curse of Strahd and I ran Tomb of Annihilation, those are two adventures where I felt like I had a lot of freedom to let the game go in interesting directions. And that when I found things in those games, I have the freedom to change those adventures, but I don't have to.
Right.
And the things that I do have to are small, and they're like turning a dial a quarter bit. With Descent into Avernus and Rime of the Frostmaiden, I reading them, I felt like there were major structural problems. There was foundational problems that I had to address to get the game to work. And in the case of like Frostmaiden, I feel like I'm hitting them while I'm running it. I'm like, ooh, how's that going to work? Right. And then I have to turn the dial again. So they have a new one coming out, you know, and I'll buy everything they put out. I love what Wizards puts out. The production value is really high. So they have a new one called Witchlight, and I don't even know the full title. Witchlight is somewhere in there. And it's a fey adventure. And so what I'm excited about is an adventure that is not a grim dark, you're either in hell or the frozen wastelands of the frozen north, where hopefully we can see some whimsy, you know, put the fantasy back into the fantasy RPG. Yep. So I'm excited about that. I'm really excited by all the really excellent third-party stuff that's coming out. Two publishers in particular that I have been following, which are both big. So I'm trying to shine more attention to smaller publishers too, because like Kobold Press is putting out phenomenal stuff. They put out like four major books a year. They have four Kickstarters a year, plus a bunch of other stuff. And their quality is excellent and real high quality stuff. So they have a new dungeon delving book that's coming out. They have a new campaign source book for the Southlands coming out. A lot of great stuff. The other group that has now started to make a real impact on 5e, I don't know on popularity, but certainly been quality, is Monty Cook Press.
Yeah.
So, you know, Monty Cook was on the plate. He was one of the, I guess he was a contractor for Wizards during D&D Next, left Wizards and really fired up Monty Cook Games and made a game called Numenera. And Numenera is an awesome RPG.
It's a phenomenal game.
I said I would be playing 13th Age. I think I'd probably be playing Numenera. So I love it to death. Well, Monty Cook Games has started to make more 5e stuff, and they put out a great big book. They had a Kickstarter for it called Arcana of the Ancients, which is all like bringing science tech, you know, fantasy technology into a 5e game. And I used a lot of it in an Eberron game that I ran. It worked really well. They have a big book of monsters called Beasts of Flesh and Steel. They have adventures that they put out, like campaign adventures that they put out that are really cool. So I'm really enjoying seeing the stuff that's coming. Oh, and they brought up Tolis. You know, have you seen Tolis?
I have not.
Oh my God. Hang on. I know this is make for great radio.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it's a 670 page campaign book by
Monty
Cook.
Unbelievable.
Here, let me put it on my desk. Right.
Oh, so like that's incredible. It's like two encyclopedias.
It is. It's huge. Yeah. It's like 2 inches deep. And so this was a campaign that Monty Cook had made for third edition. This was his test to run third edition and try it. And he made a city a 1-20 city campaign. And he then remade it for both Cypher system, which is the system that runs Numenera. And he made a fifth edition version too. And I was super eager to, you know, because this is like, I don't think you can, you know, they can't make a lot of these, right?
No.
I mean, I think it's $150 too. So it wasn't cheap. Yeah. The MSRP is $150. So, but it's just a fun artifact to have.
I'd be curious, like, what did you grok so hard in that? Like, why did you like that so much? What impressed you about it? I mean, other than the size of it.
Yeah. Working my shoulders, like, you know. So I love the idea of an entire campaign that's built in a city that goes to 20th level, and that it has like this central spire where you're seeing like the bad guy, right? Like, you know, like one day, like, you know, 2 years from now, we're going to be up in that tower fighting some huge horror, but now we're going down to the sewer to fight some rats, you know. And I like that it's this entire self-contained campaign world.
That's
my
cool.
Only problem is I just ran a big campaign where half of it was set in the city of Sharn in Eberron, and I'm like, I can't do another big city campaign. So in a couple of years, maybe I'll whip that thing out. We'll try it again. But yeah, so I'm really excited to look at like what third party publishers coming out, you know, and like Kickstarter has sort of, you talked about those like notches up, right? Kickstarter's hit another one where now we regularly have 7-figure Kickstarters for D&D books. And you've got Nord Games and Ghostfire Games and 2C Gaming and all these different small companies that are now making outstanding products. They're hiring staff. Yep. You know, my friend Sean Merwin is like the lead creative guy at Ghostfire Games, right? Sean is an incredible dude. So, you know, it's really great. Celeste Konowich got hired by 2C Gaming and has brought her campaign setting to there.
Amazing.
So we're seeing a lot of really great third-party stuff coming out that, in my opinion, rivals and in many cases surpasses what WotC is putting out for 5e.
WotC's doing.
And I think that's outstanding, right? It means that D&D doesn't, you know, isn't held to one company.
Right. You know? Right. Is there, in your mind, are we anywhere near a fear of the open license bubble that we experienced way back when?
I mean, I don't think so.
Good.
Because the world is so different than it was. And if you're worried about a glut of products, all you have to do is go to the DMs Guild and drive through RPG. And that glut has been there for like years, right? There's thousands and thousands of products. And some of them people will pick up and some they won't. So I don't think so. And I don't know the actual history of the OGL glut and when they, you know, had those problems. I think that was mostly a games shop problem where they didn't know which titles they needed to have on the shelf at any given time. And every title was sort of eating up every other title.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now
it was a quality issue too.
Sure. But like, the problem with the quality doesn't matter if nobody's looking at it.
Right.
And so now we have stores where you can have a million titles and that's okay. Right. And the quality, like, I guarantee you this will come as a shock to you, but I bet you not every single DMs Guild product is super well done and, you know, has everything going well. So certainly not, cause I have some stuff there. So, you know, I don't know that there's a limit. Right. Yeah. Like you would think, like I make ignorant statements on Twitter and then people come to my house. But like I made an ignorant statement that like I don't need another campaign setting. Like I'm good. Right. I have more campaign settings that I could run. I don't need any more. And people are like, man, you're an idiot. Like, you know, why would you limit something like that has this unlimited horizon? And I'm like, yeah, you're right. Why would I? That's stupid. Of course I like campaign settings. And of course I'll pick up more because every one of them is fuel for my imagination, right? Like,
exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, so it was a dumb statement.
Well, there's two hobbies, Mike. Buying the books and running the books, right? And they're two separate hobbies.
Maybe glancing at them occasionally. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. Like I have like 2,000 PDFs in my 5e collection alone, right?
Yeah.
Like I buy everything and it's nothing. Cause like, all my shelves are filled with D&D books, of course, but like, this is like 5% of all the products I own because hard drives are cheap.
Right.
And like, so I think those are things that didn't really exist when that OGL glut was there. Is now there's no bottom, it's a bottomless cavern, right? We can, we could fill it forever.
Well, and I think we've also had a lot of innovation since then, too. The distance between creating and production have gotten smaller. You don't need the distributors like the way that you had to before in order to reach an audience. I think that's a really big deal. I had Dennis Detwiller on. He had a great commentary about, you know, if you're not creating something right now, then that's on you. Right. If you're not selling, then that's on you too. He makes an argument that quality is found, that it's out there and that it's not just a single piece of pie and everybody's slicing it up and there's a limited thing.
Yes,
he's a firm believer the pie gets bigger and bigger. Yeah. And I don't disagree with that at all. He tends to say it in a much more caustic way than I do because he's Dennis, but I don't think he's wrong. I don't think he's wrong on that.
And talking to my publisher, I have some publisher friends of mine that we get together and kind of talk shop and make fun of people. And going back to the seven-figure Kickstarters is like there's no lack of money in this industry, right? Like, you know, it could be, you know, and the only thing I would change on like the if you want to create something, nothing is in your way to create it. You know, if you want to make money, everything is in your way.
Two separate things though, right?
Right. And I would say like the world doesn't owe you their attention, right? No one, you know, you don't deserve to have everyone's attention. You have to fight for it. And you got to be really lucky. You know,
yeah,
I think like effort and luck together are the things that
luck is a big part of it. And just embracing that and
doesn't help. Right.
No, just accept it. Right. Accept it. And it's not just, you know, putting out 5e D&D. The reason I'm in the job I'm in, 50% luck.
Yeah,
let's be honest.
Everything around me. I mean, my existence in the universe.
Exactly.
Was complete luck. So like, Yeah, and like that, that, you know, those odds are really terrible.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It's so true, and I get in this argument at times with people like that. Doesn't say I don't work hard.
Sure, right?
You saying that you were lucky to be able to find the audience with Lazy Dungeon Master in no way takes away the amount of effort and talent and work that went into making it.
Yeah.
But just saying, look, I got kind of lucky.
Yeah, yeah. It takes,
and that's okay.
You can, just like you think about it with die rolls, right? And it's like, well, is a plus three sword better than a plus one sword? Yeah. But it's only swinging you 10% on that die roll, right? It's not the end. It's not going from a hit to a miss every time. It's just steering the odds. So can you help steer the odds? Yes.
Yeah.
You know, there are things I work all the time. Right. And it's like, all I'm doing is steering the odds. Right.
Yep. That's a great way to put it. Is there anything from an industry standpoint that makes you really happy right now or makes you excited about tomorrow?
Oh, man. I mean, this whole industry makes me happy, you know, and I guess the constant continuing growth makes me happy.
Yeah.
The expansion of voices makes me really happy.
Oh, it's so great.
Right. And seeing the demographic change and seeing, you know, seeing that the hobby is embracing diversity and, you know, rejecting, you know, ignorance. Right.
Yep.
And I think that that's important.
I agree.
And yeah, so I'm very happy about that. I guess, is there something more specific? I don't know. It's hard to say. I'm just, I really just try to see the future with open eyes, you know, I don't know what's going to be good. I don't know what's going to be bad.
Sure. Yeah. I'm not asking for predictions.
And I'm excited. And I'm just excited to see new things come out. You know,
I think to a certain degree, people can not fully understand what your first point was and how big that is, that the circle's getting bigger.
Yeah.
People that we didn't hear before, we're hearing now, and they're participating now, and they're being part of that. It's a really big deal. And I'm also very much into miniature gaming and war games and stuff like that. RPGs are so ahead of the curve on this. It's not even funny. It's not even funny to the point where when I go back to my miniature gaming world and look, I'm like, what the fuck, guys? Like, get your shit together, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that RPGs have figured it out.
Right.
I'm just saying that they're ahead, right? Yeah. And headed in the right direction.
There are bumps in that road.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think is really interesting about it, and there's something I've always loved about this hobby, because I always worry for the shoe to drop. Like I was talking to somebody who's been in this industry for 30 years, and they're kind of a mentor of mine, and I'm like, well, I don't know what's this thing that's happening. Help! And they're like, this is why that's happening. Oh, okay, right. And I asked him, like, you know, should I quit my job? And he's like, nope. And he's like, I've been through two of these bubbles before, and you don't know. Maybe it's different. Maybe it's not, right? But I can tell you it's happened before, and it's been up and then it's down, and then it's up and then it's down. So, you know, so be prepared, right? Prepare yourself for ups and downs. And the thing I love about it is, like, if I have the three core books, I can play D&D for the rest of my life. And nothing in the world, you know, I was like, D&D is the only hobby I've had, maybe fountain pens, that can survive a nuclear war.
Nice. Right?
Where, like, we could lose all electronics in the world and be sitting around campfires still playing D&D, you know, and all we need are the books, and no one can take them away from us.
Yep.
And even if, like, I picked up the old school essentials book, right? Like,
this book
that sort of captures all of the original 0E D&D style.
Yep.
And I looked at it and I was like, isn't it amazing that this one book that cost me like $30 has this game that I could just sit and play with my friends forever
for the rest of your life,
for the rest of my life. And that's like, nobody could take it from me. It's not going to degrade. If I put it on a shelf and take care of it, it will be the same as it was when I bought it. No other piece of electronics, no other video game, you know, will be like that, you know, but, you know, I mean, there have been polyhedral dice since Rome.
Right.
You know, and so I love that aspect of it. I love the longevity and the resilience that this game can have, regardless of like what happens. Like, there's always this worry of like, well, what if WotC fucks things up, right? Like, what if they go down this route and they're like Hasbro move the vice president of WotC up to, or move the, you know, WotC president up to vice president role, all this like politics. And now they're going to like make bubblegum, you know, new sugar drinks based on characters from D&D. And then like they just dick with the whole game. And it's like, that's okay. I've got 5e and I love it.
Right.
So I'm good. And even if I didn't, I still have every other one of these games and they're good too. And people are going to keep making new ones and those are going to be good. So like, it's just, it's so different. Like, you know, when I was big into EverQuest, that like I had to work with the develop. Like I was as kind of into EverQuest as I am in D&D, and like I knew the developers of the game. And I remember there was like this meta game where if you could convince the developers to beef up your weapon, it was as good as getting a new weapon in game, right? And so you work both angles.
Sure.
But the key was like they could dick up the game and you'd never play it again.
Yeah,
because they own every aspect of the game.
Right.
No one, like, you know, so Xanathar's Guide came out for 5th edition and it's really great. Tasha's came out and I'm not as crazy about it. Right. Like some stuff in there is amazing and really, really good. And then there's some stuff in there that's like weird and complicated and doesn't work as well as I'd hope. And like, oh, they broke D&D. No, like I just say, hey, we're not going to use those builds, guys.
Exactly.
Right? And me and my five friends at my table, I'll make an agreement that we don't want to use a thing. And then it's we're fine, right? And the game is solid. So that's you know, one thing I love about it is knowing that this game will be around basically for as long as humanity is around.
Yeah, and I'll tell you the other thing that I find very interesting, and it's a surprise for me, is the economics of the industry. Because one of the big, big problems with the industry is you buy one book and you entertain dozens of people and they don't buy another book. Right. You know, you don't have to. But with things like Patreon, with the success of Kickstarter and stuff like that, we've now see the money. We see people have been wanting to spend the money and we see that money flooding in. And that's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there is sort of like the shoe drop problem, right? Which I think about it from my own, you know, because now I've gone from hobbyist to kind of a business, right?
Sure.
And luckily for me, I have other sources of income. So I'm like, you know, I'll be fine. I followed my advice from my mentor and said, no, I won't quit my job. I'll lower the hours, but I can always bring those hours back up if things go back.
Exactly.
And, but I look at the numbers. And one thing I worry about is like someday everybody who wants Return to the Lazy Dungeon Master is going to have it. And then like my sales, which have been going fine, are going to go poop and they're going to fall right off a cliff and no one will buy it again. And, you know, so I do think that like unlike a subscription-y sort of service, you bring a Patreon, right? And unlike a subscription sort of service where you sort of always have to keep paying me in order to get your thing. I don't want to do that. I want people to buy a book and own it. Right.
Right.
Because I have the same resilience we were talking about, but I do worry that like, you know, will there be a point where it just kind of falls off this cliff? And hopefully I have another big book that does well, but I haven't since then. Like I've written a lot of books since then and they're great and they're doing fine, but they're not like that.
Sure.
And, you know, so, and that was what happened with Wizards of the Coast, right? That like when they did these books, they saw that there was this big steep drop off in people who bought the core books. And luckily for 5th, that hasn't happened. The core books have been continuing to sell year after year. They said that 30% growth in 2020, right? So, which is nuts because they've been doubling every 18 months in like the previous 5 years.
Yeah.
So, But eventually everybody will. And then you think like, oh, it's going and it's not going to trail off. It's going to fall off a cliff because everybody will have. I have no idea if that's true. I'm not an economist and I haven't studied it in the past.
Well,
but I
mean, it is.
That seems now, like it could be a problem.
It's not an if, it's a when. Right.
Yeah.
And there's that's also WotC's not going to sit there and watch it happen either. Right. So
right.
We can't make the assumption like there's people
they've
much
got,
smarter than
got
you
a
and
6E
I.
Vault. Right. They got a 6E vault ready to pull. Right. Here you go.
Exactly.
Brand new
exactly.
One.
Yeah. Yeah. There's people a lot smarter than you and I running that company right now. And they're going to see that coming around.
I'm not so
they
sure
are.
I'd say that go that far.
When it comes to this type of stuff, I mean, here's the way to think about it. Who's got the most skin in the game? Right.
Sure. But human
and
beings
are
irrational creatures, no matter where they are.
Right. But we don't have one human making those decisions.
Yeah,
I guess that's what I'm thinking.
Is.
All right.
Lorraine Williams thought it was a really good idea to make a 6th edition D&D.
Well, I'm not saying that. Yeah. We don't disagree as much as we think we do.
Yeah, I mean, to me, one of the things that I think about, like, so a lot of times I read like Reddit or my Discord server and stuff, and people bring up 6e and like, when's that coming out? And there actually is an interesting bit of evidence that they're not going to come out with 6E in the immediate future based on investments that they've made. But for before those, there was like, when is it coming out? Is it going to come out soon? And everybody like had like mathematical models that they built of like, oh, it's going to come out at this time. And I was like, look at every instance of the previous editions. And almost every one was basically one person making a choice, you know, a senior executive or a new president or whatever. And yeah, Lorraine Williams made second edition, and then Wizards of the Coast bought TSR and they made a third edition. And I don't know, and 3.5, I don't know what happened. But then 4E was like, hey, we want to do video games. You know, we want to change the brand for that. And then fifth edition, and I loved it. And I think it was Leeds was the guy's name. And I actually got to stand there and hear him say it to an interview, he was doing a podcast with a friend of mine, and I heard him say it. And they said, like, you just let an entire branch of your development team spend 2 years not making a product to play test a new edition of D&D. How are you paying for that? And he's like, Magic. You know, Magic the Gathering's paying for it, and we're fine with that. And I was like, he made that choice. He could have easily said, never mind, we're going to turn it into branding, and we're going to give it to movies and TV shows, and we're not doing another edition, and fire all those people. He could have done that. Instead, he's like, now let's see how it goes. So, you know, maybe he didn't have a bad sandwich that day, and, you know, and instead he could have just as likely gone one direction or the other. So I think that makes new editions a relatively unpredictable variable, right? But the interesting variable that has changed things is and many of my publisher friends who did think a 6E was inevitable changed their minds, and it was WotC bringing in-house a major translation team to make foreign language or non-English language versions of 5E. And they said, like, you don't spend that kind of money to translate books into four languages if you're going to make a new version in like a year or two. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I didn't even make that assessment, but like enough of my friends did.
Yeah.
But no, that's always dangerous too, because they're all experts. And as we know, experts are terrible at prediction. So
we need 1,000 people to tell us.
Yeah. I should probably go back and like do a couple of tweet polls. Right.
Yeah.
And see what Twitter has to say, because they're probably more accurate.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Mike, I really appreciate you making the time, man.
Yeah, this is great. Outstanding. I always love talking about this stuff.
So obviously we're going to have links in the show notes. So everybody's listening, you can scroll down right now and you can see links to all the books that we've talked about, including his Amazon store, where you can check out the other books that people need to be buying more than just Lazy Dungeon Master, because it's good stuff too.
Buy if you want it. Like, I'm not going to push anything.
In general, Mike, if someone who wants more Mike outside of, you know, outside of the books, where should they go?
Sly Flourish. So go to slyflourish.com, my website. The front page, I regularly, so the front page is hand edited, except for a little block that has like the latest articles, but everything else I go there and I try to make sure that all of the other aspects, if you want me and your life in different ways, whether it's YouTube or podcast or Discord or Twitter or, you know, I don't know what, I'm not on TikTok yet, but, you know, oh, newsletter, you know, my social network of the future, an email newsletter.
And, you're so ahead of times.
I'll give you a little publisher tip, 20 times more effective than Twitter.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. So it surprises lots of other people. So yeah, newsletter is a really effective mechanism, shockingly, given how much of a trend
email is.
Well,
I'm going
to
add to that, Mike. A good newsletter is more effective, right?
Yeah. And I'm not sure I'm there yet. Like, I
like it. I enjoy it. I like you. You and Force. I think both you guys have good newsletters.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. But there's other newsletters and I'm like, yeah, I'm good. Thanks.
Yeah. The thing I'm trying to do is recognize that more people now get my blog articles as a newsletter than they do reading the blog. So I need to think of it as I'm writing a newsletter that's getting published on my site, not the other way around. And I'm not there yet. The main thing I'm trying to do is just keep them shorter, you know, get it down. And that's also what I did with YouTube, is like, you know, what made that big stair step with YouTube was going to 3 to 5 minute videos rather than an hour of me talking about nonsense. So, subscribing to my newsletter is great. But if you want to see all the other ways, there's a big block that says, hey, if you want more Sly Flourish in your life, here's
beautiful
8 different ways and pick which ones you want. I won't be insulted.
You know, okay, great.
I won't be insulted if you only pick one.
Like I said, guys, you can scroll down right now. We've got a links to all of that. All right, Mike, we're going to have to figure out a reason and an excuse to have you come back on.
Sure.
All right.
Do I need to give you one?
No, we'll do that off air.
All right, great.
And for those of you that stuck around all the way to the end, I appreciate you too. Thanks for listening. Take care.
this episode, subscribe to Tabletop Talk and share it with your friends. Check out our content on YouTube and Twitch. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and stay updated on everything coming from Third Floor. All the links are in the show notes. Take care, floorheads.
Hey, are you still here? Wow. Well, the episode is over, but if you're bored, why not go to patreon.com and support the show for as little as $1 a month? Yeah, you can just scroll down and yeah, get the link. It's Patreon that makes this and all of our other content possible. Don't you want to join the other floorheads on the Patreon Discord? Anyway, thanks for sticking around. Take care. Bye.